an Osho talk. Walking in Zen, sitting in Zen.
Talks on Zen stories, number 13.
The first question. How can I become a light unto myself? These were the last words of Gautama the Buddha. His parting message to his disciples. Be a light unto yourself. But when he says, be a light unto yourself, he does not mean, become a light unto yourself. There is a great difference between being and becoming. Becoming is a process. Being is a discovery. The seed only appears to become the tree. That is an appearance. The seed had already the tree in itself. It was its very being. The seed does not become the flowers. The flowers were there, unmanifest. Now they are manifest. It is not a question of beginning. Otherwise, a pebble can become a flower. But that doesn't happen. A rock can become a rose. That does not happen. Because the rock has no potential for the rose. The seed simply discovers itself through dying into the soil. Dropping its outer self, it becomes revealed into its inner reality. Man is a light in the seed. You are already Buddhas. Not that you have to become Buddhas. It is not a question of learning, of achieving. It is only a question of recognition. It is a question of going within yourself and seeing what is there. It is self-discovery. You are not to become a light unto yourself. It is already the case, but you don't go in. Your whole journey is outwards. We are being brought up in such a way that we all become extroverts. Our eyes become focused on the outside. We are always seeking and searching for some goal. There, far away. Farther the goal, more challenging it appears to the ego, more difficult it is, more attractive it appears. The ego exists through challenges. It wants to prove itself. It is not interested in the simple. It is not interested in the ordinary. It is not interested in the natural. It is interested into something which is neither natural, nor simple, nor ordinary. Its desire is for the extraordinary. And the reality is very ordinary. It is very simple. The reality is not there but here, not then but now, not outside but in the innermost sanctum of your being. You have just to close your eyes and look in. In the beginning it is difficult, because the eyes only know how to look out. They have become so accustomed of looking out that when you close them, then too they continue to look out. They start dreaming. They start fantasizing. Those dreams are nothing but reflections of the outside. So only apparently you seem to be with closed eyes, but your eyes are still open to the outside world. You are not in. In fact, every meditator comes across this strange phenomenon, that whenever you close your eyes, your mind becomes more restless. Your mind becomes more insane. It starts chattering in a crazy way, relevant, irrelevant thoughts crisscross your being. It is never so when you are looking outside. And naturally you become tired. Naturally you think it is better to remain occupied into something, into some work, rather than sitting silently with closed eyes. Because nothing seems to happen except a long, long procession of thoughts, desires, memories, and they go on coming, unending. But this is only in the beginning. Just a little patience. Just a little awaiting. If you go on looking, watching these thoughts, silently, with no judgment, with no antagonism, with no desire even to stop them, as if you have no concern with them, unconcerned, just as one watches the traffic on the roads, or one watches the clouds in the sky, or one watches a river flow by, you simply watch your thoughts. You are not those thoughts. You are the watcher. remembering it that I am the watcher, not the watched. You cannot be the watched. You cannot be the object of your own subjectivity. You are your subjectivity. You are the witness. You are consciousness. Remembering it takes a little time. Slowly, slowly, the old habit dies. It dies hard, but it dies certainly. And the day the traffic stops, suddenly you are full of light. You have always been full of light. Just those thoughts were not allowing you to see that which you are. When all objects have disappeared, there is nothing else to see, you recognize yourself for the first time. You realize yourself for the first time. It is not becoming. It is a discovery of being. The outer cell of the thoughts of the mind is dropped and you have discovered your flowers. You have discovered your fragrance. This fragrance is freedom. Hence, don't ask, how can I become a light unto myself? You are already a light unto yourself. Just you are not aware of it. You have forgotten about it. You have to discover it. And the how of discovery is simple, very simple. A simple process of watching your thoughts. To help this process, you can start watching other things too. Because the process of watching is the same. What you are watching is not significant. Watch anything. And you are learning watchfulness. Listen to the birds. It is the same. One day you will be able to listen to your own thoughts. The birds are a little farther away. Your thoughts are a little closer. In the fall, watch the dry leaves falling from the trees. Anything will do that helps you to be watchful. Walking, watch your own walking. Buddha used to say to his disciples, take each step watchfully. He used to say, watch your breath. And that is one of the most significant practices for watching. Because breath is there continuously available for 24 hours, wherever you are. The birds may be singing one day, they may not be singing some other day. But the breathing is always there. Sitting, walking, lying down. It is always there. Go on watching. The breath coming in, the breath going out. Not that watching the breath is the point. The point is learning how to watch. Go to the river and watch the river. Sit in the marketplace and watch people passing by. Watch anything. Just remember that you are a watcher. Don't become judgmental. Don't be a judge. Once you start judging, you have forgotten that you are a watcher. You have become involved. You have taken sides. You have chosen that I am in favor of this thought and I am against that thought. Once you choose, you become identified. Watchfulness is the method of destroying all identification. Gurdjieff hence called his process the process of non-identification. It is the same. His word is different. Don't identify yourself with anything. And slowly, slowly, one learns the ultimate art of watchfulness. That's what meditation is all about. Through meditation, one discovers one's own light. That light you can call your soul, yourself, your God, whatsoever word you choose, or you can remain just silent because it has no name. It is a nameless experience. Tremendously beautiful, ecstatic, utterly silent. But it gives you the taste of eternity, of timelessness, of something beyond death. The second question, will surrender happen only when I am ready to die for you? With mark. I am not telling you to die for me. I am telling you just the opposite, to live for me. The surrender will happen only when you start living for me. I am not a worshipper of death. I am a worshipper of life. I am not here to teach you some kind of martyrhood. Enough of it. For thousands of years, stupid people have been sacrificed by the cunning ones. Somebody was dying for Christianity, somebody was dying for Mohammedanism, somebody was dying for Hinduism. Everybody was dying. As if death is the goal. And nobody was being taught how to live. Live for God, because God is life. And of course, God is also death. But death is beautiful only when it comes out of a fulfilled life, when it is the ultimate flowering of life. When death is a sacrifice, it is ugly. Then you are dying for some cause, for some purpose, for some wasted interest, then some cunning politician, some cunning priest is using you as a means to his own ends. Of course, he promises you. Otherwise, how you are going to sacrifice your life? He promises you everything after death. Now, nobody knows what happens after death. So it is very easy to promise after death. I promise you everything before death, not after death. That is the way of the cunning people. Promising you after death. You sacrifice now. And the rewards will be given after your death. Now nobody knows what happens after death. Mohammedans say if you die in a jihad, in a religious war, you may be a sinner, but you will directly go to heaven because you are dying for religion. The same is the attitude of the Christians. And the same is the attitude of all the religions. And who would not like to go to heaven and all the heavenly pleasures? And they are eternal, and this life is momentary. And this life is going to finish anyway, sooner or later. And what is there so much to be worried about in this life? It is ugly. It is painful. It is a suffering. It is a misery. These same people have made this life so miserable that anybody would like to die. I have heard a British politician was talking to Adolf Hitler just before the Second World War started. He had gone to persuade him not to enter into this foolish war. It is not going to help anybody. It will be destructive to the whole world. But Adolf Hitler was adamant. In fact, he thought that coming of this diplomat simply shows the weakness of the English people. He made it a point to prove to this diplomat that we are going to fight, and it is better and in your favor if you surrender easily. Otherwise, you will be unnecessarily massacred, killed and destroyed. He showed him all scientific developments that they have done, that they were going to use in war. Of course, they were the most superior power of those days. They had the most developed technology, war technology particularly. And then finally to prove that not only machines are there which are far bigger and better than you have, we also have men which are ready to die. To make the point absolutely clear, he came out of his room with the diplomats. They were on the fourth story of a building. Three guards were there. He ordered the first guard to jump out of the window. The man simply jumped. The British diplomat was aghast. He could not believe his eyes. The man even did not think twice. As Adolf Hitler said, jump, he jumped. There is no question to ask why he could not believe his eyes. And then he said to the second, jump, and the second man jumped. By that time, the English diplomat became aware of what is happening. Two lives lost. He looked from the window. Their bodies were just in pieces, in fragments, spread all over the road. Adolf Hitler saw that he is impressed, tremendously impressed. In fact, he was in such a shock, he could not believe such an inhuman act to hit the iron while it is hot. He ordered the third man. By this time, the diplomat was alert. He jumped immediately, took hold of the arm of the third man and said, "Are you mad or what? Why are you jumping? Why are you so eager to die? Don't you want to live?" The man looked with anger and said, "Do you call it life? Is it life? Is it worth living? Death is far better. Life is so miserable. Death is a relief. Leave my hands and let me jump." If life is so miserable, and Adolf Hitler had made life miserable, everybody was ready to die. First make people's life miserable. Don't let them enjoy life. Destroy all roots of enjoyment. Teach them all kinds of inhibitions. Tell them sex is sin. Love is sin. Teach them to drink, to eat, to be merry. These are the goals of ugly materialists. Tell them to be self-destructive. Prepare them for a kind of masochistic lifestyle in which they become ascetics and they become experts in torturing themselves. And then naturally they would like to get rid of this life as soon as possible. Then it is very easy to persuade them. In fact, there is no need to persuade. They are already ready, just waiting for the opportunity. And whenever such a great opportunity arises to die in a religious war, when heaven is so close and so easily available, who would like to miss it? Everybody is ready to die. No, that is not my idea of religion, Mark. Do you know? Mark means a warrior, a soldier. Mythologically, it means the god of war. I have changed his name, but just by changing his name, it is not so easy to change his mind. I have given him the name Vitmark. Vitmark means go beyond wars, go beyond fighting, go beyond the very idea of fight. But he asks, will surrender happen only when I am ready to die for you? Vitmark, I don't want anybody to die for me. I am not a sadist. I want you to live for me. I want you to blossom and flower for me. I want you to eat, drink and be merry for me. I want you to celebrate for me. I want you to live your life as totally, as fully as possible. Yes, death will come. But when it comes out of a fulfilled life, it has a beauty of its own. It is not death then, not at all. It is the door to the divine. But you need not die. Your work is to live. That is your sadhana. That's my whole teaching. Live, because that's the only way to show gratitude towards God. He has given you life. And you want to die. No reason is worth dying. Find out every excuse to live. And live to the utmost. And live to the maximum. And don't live in a minimum way. That's how people are living. People are living only very minor potential of their total. Just a small potential of their total. Not more than 7%. Even your greatest geniuses live not more than 15% of their potential. While you can live 100%. Only once in a while a Buddha, a Krishna, a Christ lives at the 100%. If you can live at the 100%, if you can burn your life's torch from the both ends together simultaneously, then you are surrendered to me. Surrendered to life is surrendered to me. I don't stand against life. I simply represent life. Love. Laughter. Of course, this is far more difficult. That I know. Dying is so simple. It is so easy. Living is difficult. Arduous. Dying does not need much intelligence. Any fool can be a soldier. In fact, only fools can be soldiers. And anybody can commit suicide. What intelligence is needed? Any idiot can do it. Just jump from any mountain. into any river, into any ocean. Or now even far better and simple processes are available. Just take few sleeping pills and die silently. There is no need to make much fuss, because even jumping from the mountain peak, you may hesitate. You will have to take a decision. Just swallowing some pills is not that big a problem. You can easily do it. You can inject poison. Dying is not any value. Living is really accepting a great challenge. Moment to moment, one has to live into 1001 problems, throw 1001 problems, and yet one has to keep one's cool. That's the way of a sannyasin. A sannyasin is not a soldier. So you are not expected to be martyrs. You are expected to be lovers of life. And the more you love life, the closer you are to God. Because it is His gift. Destroying His gift is ugly, is irreligious, is a sin. Wheat mark, learn to live for me. I am giving you a bigger task, I know. And it is a lifelong process. Death can happen in a single moment. Unless you are really unfortunate, death can happen in a single moment. Mulla Nasruddin wanted to commit suicide. Being a man, a very calculative nature, he made all the arrangements possible. In case one arrangement fails, another will work. He went to the top of a small hillock with a rope, with kerosene, with a matchbox, with a pistol. He found a beautiful place, a branch of a tree which was going just above the river from the top of the hill. He made arrangements to hang himself with the tree. Every possibility was that just the rope will do and he will die. But if something goes wrong, he had other arrangements, alternatives. So he hangs himself. Before hanging himself, he pours kerosene on his body, hangs himself, puts fire to his clothes, But who knows? So as a final result, suits himself also. The bullet hits the rope. He falls into the river. The river puts the fire off. Next day I meet him in the marketplace. I said, Nasruddin, what happened? He said, it was just luck. He told the whole story. And I said, this is really something. You had made so much arrangements. He said, yes, I had made so much arrangements. If I had not known how to swim, I would have died. But he knew swimming. So he is still alive. Unless something like this happens, which is very rare, unless the whole existence conspires against you, you can kill yourself very easily. But living is a long process. It will need guts, not only stupidity. It will need intelligence. The more intelligent you are, the deeper will be the quality of your life. The higher will be the value of your life. The more meditative you are, the more you will be able to know what life really is. It is nothing but God in a manifest form. To destroy this for any reason whatsoever is wrong, is a sin. So remember it. You are not here to die for me. You are here to learn how to live. Let death come as the ultimate reward of living. And if you have lived rightly, you will be able to live through death too. You will be able to live death too. And that is the most beautiful experience. Because it is through living death that one transcends death and becomes one with the eternal. The third question, I still don't accept myself. Why not? It is because you are conditioned to be perfectionists. And perfection is such an ideal that everybody falls short of it, then condemnation, self-condemnation arises. These are the tricks that have been played upon you. Beware of these tricks. It is time that man should be mature enough to know that imperfection is the way of life. Everything is imperfect. And it is beautiful that things are imperfect. If everything was perfect and everyone was perfect, life will be so dull and boring that it will be impossible to tolerate it even for a single moment. I perfectly agree with Bertrand Russell. He used to say that he does not want to go to heaven. Jokingly, humorously, because in fact he never believed that there is any heaven or hell. But he used to say that even if there is heaven, I would prefer hell, because in hell you will find good company. In heaven, you are bound to be bored, utterly bored. Just think living with saints for eternity. Mahatma Gandhi is sitting on one side. And so many saints, Jaina, Hindu, Mohammedan, Christian, Buddhist, and just to live with them, they don't even know how to play poker. They don't even drink beer. What to say of beer? They will not even be ready to drink Coca-Cola, because there is cocaine in it. And smoking, of course, is not possible in heaven, because it contains nicotine. In fact, life will be so impossible with these saints, and they will never laugh. Laughter is for imperfect human beings. Christians say Jesus never laughed. If Christians are right, then Jesus must have been absolutely a wrong person. But I know that they are not right. Jesus must have laughed. Must have. His whole life, says, he enjoyed small things of life. He even enjoyed drinking wine. Now, I don't think your saints will allow him in heaven. They will call him a drunkard, throw him out. And he lived with drunkards and gamblers and prostitutes. Your saints will be very angry. The rabbis who crucified Jesus may be allowed in heaven, but not Jesus. He is too human, too alive, too imperfect. Bertrand Russell is right that in heaven you are not going to find good company. You will see sad faces, long faces, everybody almost dead. And what these people will be doing there? No gossiping. Even you cannot sermonize, because whom you will sermonize? They are all sermonizers. You cannot find disciples in heaven. They are all masters. And Jainas say, no woman has ever entered heaven. Now you see the utter boredom. Just these ugly, half-starving saints, and not even a single woman. It will be like a desert without any oasis. Have you seen? If in a room a dozen men are sitting, it is full of a different vibe. And let one beautiful woman enter, and the vibration immediately changes. The desert is no more desert. One oasis has come in. They all become alive. Their kundalinis start arising. Those who had fallen asleep, they wake up. Buddhas go on telling, wake up, and they won't listen. And just let Sophia Loren enter. And immediately all the saints are alive, awake, fully awake. But Jainas say no woman can enter in heaven. If a woman is religious and spiritual, she will be born in her next life as a man. And then she can go to heaven, but only from a man's body, never from a woman's body. As if souls are also male and female. As if bodies also go to heaven. What kind of stupidity this? But the fear. A woman can create disturbance. And naturally, if for centuries no woman has entered in heaven, and suddenly one woman enters, there will be great commotion. There will be great disturbance, chaos. And great fight will break out. And all the saints will be at each other's throats. A jihad, a religious war for the woman. Everybody will be ready to die. You have been told to be perfectionists. That's why this problem arises. It is not only your problem, everybody's problem. But remember a few things. First, all evil is potential vitality in need of transformation. Even evil is to be accepted. Because evil is potential vitality in need of transformation. Anger is potential vitality. Accept it. I am not saying that remain angry. It is through acceptance that you can transform anger into compassion. It is the same energy that becomes compassion. I am not saying that remain sexual for your whole life. But it is the energy of sex that becomes love, and it is the energy of love that becomes prayers. Go on transforming it. But if you reject it from the very beginning, how you are going to transform it? If you condemn it, you create a barrier between yourself and your own energy. Now no transformation is possible. You become antagonistic. You become split. You are divided constantly in conflict with yourself. Your life becomes a sheer wastage. And I know that you commit many mistakes, but to err is human. Nothing to be worried about it. Nothing to make so much fuss about it. It is how one learns. It is how one by and by becomes mature. The man who never commits any mistake never grows either. It is by going astray that one learns. Hence, learn to forgive yourself again and again and again and again, because life is a constant growth. You will have to forgive yourself thousands of times. And if you cannot forgive yourself, who is going to forgive you? But you have been taught wrong values, wrong ideals, and they are heavy on your head. Don't be worried about the small things. Enjoy them. Everyone lies, cheats, pretends. Yes, you too, and most certainly, I myself. So don't be worried at all. Even Buddhas have to create false devices. I have to trick you into things in which you will not enter in any other way. I have to create devices. All devices are false. They have to be false because your illnesses are false. For example, you are suffering from ego. Now I say surrender. In the first place, the ego is a false entity. There is no ego at all. You are simply dreaming. You are making it up. But what to do? You have made it so big a thing that I tell, please surrender it to me. Rather than telling you that it doesn't exist, you won't understand right now. It is better to tell you, give it to me. Surrender it. And you feel good that at least you can do something with your ego. You can surrender. It appeals to your logic. It is like homeopathy. The illness is false, the medicine is false. Just sugar pills, nothing to be worried. Whenever you are suffering from false diseases, and remember, out of 100, almost 75% are false. Rather than torturing my doctors in the medical center, You go to Narendra Bodhisattva. He is the homeopath. Although he has not been able to cure his own headache. His whole life he has suffered from the headache. And he will not be able to cure. That is the difficulty. Because he knows all those pills are just sugar pills. But he helps others. He had helped many people. He had cured many people's headaches. And he feels puzzled. What is the matter? Why I can't cure my own headache? That's the difficulty with false medicines. If you know, they are useless. But others you can help easily. That's why there are so many pathies. Except allopathy, all pathies are more or less psychological. But they have a great appeal. For the simple reason, because if you go to the allopath, if your illness is false, he will say it is all in your mind. That does not feel good. All in my mind? You don't like that idea at all. You immediately start looking for some Ayurvedic physician. And they are clever people. They have to be very clever. You start searching for some homeopath, some naturopath, and there are hundreds of pathies available. And all pathies work. They all help. So as far as help is concerned, they are all helpful. If you go to the Ayurvedic physician, he will never say that it is in your mind. Never. He will talk much about your disease. He will analyze the disease. He may even go to your past lives. He may look at your hand. He may read your lines. He may even ask you to bring your birth chart. Now, this man seems to be that he knows what he is doing. And that foolish allopath doctor, he was simply saying it is in your head. Now he is puffing your ego. He is telling you your disease is really very dangerous and it needs a long treatment and a very careful treatment and you need a real genius physician and you have come to the right person now. And he will be able to help you. He will give you all kinds of things which are really of no value, no medicinal value. But if you start believing in him, if you go to the homeopath, he will ask your whole life history. For 3 hours he will give to you. Now, people who suffer from false diseases also suffer from talking about their diseases. They like very much to talk about their diseases. They magnify their diseases. They make them as big as possible. They have nothing else to brag about, but they have big diseases, great diseases. And the homeopath buttresses your ego. I used to know a very famous homeopath doctor, a certain Dr. Mukherjee. He was an all India famous homeopath. For 3 days, he will simply talk about your past diseases. From your very childhood, when you were 3 years of age, as long as you remember, and he will write down everything. And you are just suffering from a headache. And he will go from 3 years of age, because he will say that a history is there. No disease is a separate phenomenon. It is a continuity. And it seems logical. Everything is connected with everything else. Nothing is discontinuous. Everything relates to everything else. So unless we go to the roots, he will say, I don't touch the leaves, I go to the roots. Once I took my father to him. My father was very much interested in homeopathy, so much so that when he started talking about his childhood, he started about talking the childhood of his grandfather. He always started from there. Dr. Mukherjee looked a little worried. I laughed. I said, now, you have the right patience. Now you will know. 3 days won't do. He always used to start from his grandfather's illnesses, then his father's illnesses, then his illnesses. It took almost 10 days. Dr. Mukherjee met me one day in the garden. He said, I am tired. You please take your father to some other doctor. He is a very dangerous person. I have never come across such a person. But I cannot say anything because he is following exactly the homeopathic principle. And if one man's life diseases are connected, certainly the son's diseases are connected with the father's diseases and the father's with the grandfather's. I said, you should be happy that he does not know anything about his other ancestors. He knows only up to his grandfather. Otherwise, it would have taken years for him first to come to his illness. And what was his illness? He was suffering for 2-3 days from stomach upset. And I knew what was the reason. He always used to suffer. Whenever he will use to eat cucumbers, he will suffer. That was the simple reason, cucumbers, nothing else. No need to go to the father and the grandfather. And I told to Mukherjee, no, your homeopathic principle can be dangerous. You are a homeopath doctor and he is a homeopath. You be patient. You listen silently to him. That's why I have brought him to you. He will put you right. His problem is very simple, not connected at all with any disease. Just he has eaten cucumbers and they always give him stomach ache. It is as simple as that. Homeopathy helps you because it accepts your illnesses very seriously. And that's what you want really. That's what exactly is your desire. You want attention. And a doctor listening to you silently. That's the whole secret of psychoanalysis, particularly Freudian psychoanalysis. It helps the patient without anything. Just the psychotherapist goes on listening. The patient goes on talking for months, for years even. And the doctor has to be very patient just to listen. Whether he listens or not, that is not the point. At least he has to pretend that he is listening very attentively, and that helps. The Buddhas have devised many false methods. In fact, all methods are bound to be false, because your spiritual illnesses are all false. Because your spiritual being can never be ill. It is just your belief. And your belief has to be destroyed by something which can appeal to you in the mind in which you are right now. Don't be worried. You say, I still don't accept myself. Why? What you have done? Few mistakes here and there. Maybe you lied once to somebody. Maybe you deceived somebody. So what? This whole life is a drama. And we are all actors. And little bit of cheating is perfectly okay. It makes life a little juicy. It gives life a little spice. Otherwise, everybody telling just the truth. That happens to few foolish people who go through encounter and gestalt. This happens. They start telling the truth to anybody. Stupid people are stupid people. They won't understand anything. They write to me that, Bhagwan, now I am in trouble. I have been through the encounter and I have learned that one has to be authentic and one has to be true. So I have told my wife that many times I feel like going with some woman. Now there is great trouble. My life has become a nightmare. We are continuously quarreling. Before this encounter, everything was going smooth. Now the encounter is finished. Tirtha is gone. But with my wife, the encounter continues. And now there seems to be no end to it. What should I do now? You need not be so foolish. In an encounter group, be authentic. Even if you have to lie, lie and be authentic. If you don't know how to be authentic, pretend to be authentic. Enjoy being authentic. But don't carry this nonsense everywhere. And don't create troubles for yourself. Just think, if even for 24 hours everybody on the earth decides to tell exactly the truth, there will be no world. Finished. Think just in your mind, 24 hours, everybody telling exactly the truth and nothing else. Nobody will be a friend to you. You will not find two friends in the whole world. Every couple will be divorced. Children will leave their parents. Parents will leave their children. All will be finished. No customers will come to any shop. The world will come to a stop immediately. Nirvana for the whole world. In a single blow. This world needs few lies too. It makes life smooth. It helps. Lies are like lubricants. Start accepting yourself as you are. And watch. Be alert. Of course, 90% of it will be transformed. And the 10% will become more skillful. The fourth question: how many British ladies are here? Fortunately, not many. Only 3. One is Prem Lisa. But she is new. Very new. And I hope she will melt. She gets very much offended whenever I say anything. Lovingly against the British, she gets offended. Just the other day she has written to me, "Bhagwan, of course, the Australians are such nice people. They were originally chosen by some of the best English judges." Judges are never very nice people. Socrates was condemned by very nice Greek judges, sentenced to death, Jesus was also condemned by very nice judges, the highest rabbis, and the greatest Roman magistrates and the governors. Highly cultured people, well educated. And Jesus himself was uncultured, uneducated, just a carpenter's son, belonged to the proletariat. Pontius Pilate was certainly belonged to the highest strata of society. But do you think just because Pilate belonged to the highest strata of society, was one of the best Roman governors, he is right and Jesus is wrong? Socrates is wrong? And the judges, who were certainly the best judges of those days in Athens, and no city has ever seen such culture, such sophistication as Athens has seen. But who was right? If you ask my preference, I am always for the poor criminals and sinners, then for the saints and for the judges. Yes, it is true that the first people to reach Australia were criminals. But so was the case with America. The first people to reach America were criminals, sinners. Because sinners and criminals are more courageous people, adventurous. They were not bourgeois. The bourgeoisie is never courageous. And judges are always in the service of the wasted interests. And who knows really what is right and what is wrong? Once a Laosu was made a magistrate, knowing that he is one of the wisest men in the country, the Chinese emperor appointed him the magistrate. He wanted to escape. He wanted to be forgiven. But the emperor was very much insistent. He said, "No. You are the wisest man. You should be my greatest magistrate." He said, "Okay." The first case came into the court. A thief was caught, red-handed, and Lao Tzu gave him 6 months jail, and also gave 6 months jail to the rich man from whom he has stolen. The rich man said, "Are you in your senses? 6 months jail for me too? For what?" Lao Tzu said, "In fact, I am being very lenient with you. You should get 1 year's jail. You have accumulated the whole wealth of the town. You are the original criminal. This man comes only seconds. If you had not accumulated all the wealth, there would have been no need to steal. You have created the need to steal. In fact, you are the culprit. The rich man went to the emperor. He said, "What nonsense is this? Have you ever heard? Is there any precedent?" And the king was also worried, because if this rich man is a criminal, then what about the emperor? He relieved Lao Tzu immediately from his duties. He said, "You may be a wise man, but you are not needed. You are not able to be a judge. A judge is to follow the rules." Lao Tzu said, "I am following the ultimate law." The king said, "There is no question of ultimate law. The law that I have decided, that has to be followed." Lao Tzu said, "Your lies, all nonsense. I follow Tao. You are also one of the criminals." Now, who were those judges? For whom they were serving? For whom they were representing? They were representing the vested interests. But Lisa got angry. Sees a British lady here. Even in the discourse, she sits with dark sunglasses. I cannot even see her expressions, her eyes. Impossible. That's very British-like. Now there is no need for the sunglasses here. It is already too dark. Really to see is difficult. People are writing to me, "We cannot see you. Should we start wearing glasses?" And Lisa is wearing sunglasses. Dark. Impossible to see her eyes. That is very diplomatic and very British. But she will melt. She has fallen into my trap. Now there is no exit. It will take time. It is a difficult thing for a British lady to melt and become a sannyasin. It is such a change, such a transformation. And the second British lady is Soumendra. Although the second British lady is not in the form of a lady, but I don't look at the form. I look at the formless. This is for the first time he is laughing. Otherwise I go on telling jokes and he goes on looking at the floor. And the third British lady is not yet a sannyasin, so I cannot tell you her name. But she has been here for 7 months. Just thinking whether to take sannyas or not, to be or not to be, seems to be very Shakespearean. Seven months. And I don't think even 7 years will be enough. I cannot tell you her name, because unless somebody becomes a sannyasin, I remain very polite, very British with the non-sannyasin. Very mannerly. I talk about the climate and weather, etc. I don't talk about real matters. Once you are a sannyasin, then I start coming into my true color. So I am waiting. But she is also taking such a long time. Even my patience. Is coming to a point. Even I have started suspecting whether I can wait anymore. Should I drop the very idea? Several thousand football fans turned up to watch the match between the elephants and the insects. For the first half, the insect team came out into the field with only 10 members, and the match was a slaughterhouse. By the time the whistle blew for half-time, the elephants were winning by 10-0. When the second half of the game was resumed, the 11th member of the insect team, a centipede, took the field, and the entire match changed completely. The centipede whipped through the elephant defense time and time again. When the final whistle blew, the insects had won by 399-10. As the players marched off the field, the elephant captain strolled up to the insect captain. "How come you did not bring your star player on in the first half?" he asked. "Ah, well," explained the insect captain, "it takes him so long to get his boots on. So I am waiting. This lady seems to be a centipede, a British centipede. She is just getting ready. She goes on writing to me, what to do, should I take sannyas or not? And I cannot say to her, take. Because this is such a risky thing, I don't want to take the responsibility. If a Britisher comes on his own, it's okay. Because it is not an easy job. Even after sannyas, it is going to be a difficult thing. If it takes 7 months even to decide whether to take sannyas or not, how many years it will take to be really one with me, to be in tune with me, to understand the humor, the laughter, the joy, the bliss, the music, the poetry that prevails here. fifth question. Do you use your mind when you speak in discourse? What discourse? You call this discourse? And what mind? One can easily see that whatsoever I utter is absolutely mindless. I am a madman. What mind? One madman came to the house of another madman and knocked at the door. The man opened the window from above and shouted down, "I am not at home." The madman below looked up and said, "Well, then I am glad I did not come." And the last question. Will you please tell few jokes about the Portuguese? We poor Portuguese sannyasins feel completely ignored by you. From today, it will not be so. Late one night, Manuel is staggering home drunk, passed through a cemetery, stumbled and fell on the ground. Just in front of his nose, he saw a hand sticking out of a grave, and a voice cried, help me, let me out, I am alive. The Portuguese, shakily covering the hand with earth, replied, no. You are not alive, just badly buried. A bunch of Portuguese rugs enter a bank, hangs up everybody, shouts Joaquin, the chief. This is a hold up. Manuel, lock everybody in the toilets. Antonio, bring the manager here. The manager is brought trembling to Joaquin, who asks him for the key of the safe. Please, for God's sake, don't kill me. I left the key at home, cries the manager. Don't worry, man, replies Joaquin. It is only the rehearsal today. Tomorrow is the real thing. A Portuguese enters a hospital and says, doctor, I want to have my testicles removed. Shocked, the doctor asks, have you really given this decision your full consideration? Yes, doctor, I have really decided. I want my testicles removed. So the doctor operates on him. Weeks later, fully recovered, Manuel visits his friend, who asks him, so, Manuel, did you follow my advice? Have you had your tonsils removed? Oh my God, cries Manuel. Was it tonsils? A Portuguese was on his first flight, Rio to Lisbon. As the plane was ready to take off, the voice of the pilot came through the speakers, ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard our jumbo Boeing 747. Our plane is equipped with the most modern and sophisticated equipment for your comfort and security. We have 380 passengers aboard, a crew of 25 people, and 30 tons of cargo. We have two super-equipped kitchens that can provide 500 meals, two bars, 12 toilets, a gambling hall, two cinemas with 200 seats, a TV for each passenger, and on the upper floor, a disco with an orchestra of 20 musicians. Now, please, fasten your belts, extinguish your cigarettes, and say your prayers. We are trying to take off with all this junk. Manuel and Joaquin were hunting in the Amazon jungle when suddenly a wild animal appeared. Scared, they started to run away, but the animal followed them. Finally, Manuel climbed a tree while Joaquin started running around the tree. From the top of the tree, Manuel shouted, "Hey, Joaquin, the beast is almost on you." "Don't worry, Manuel," replied Joaquin. "I am 2 rounds ahead of him." Enough for today.